Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Hello, hello, marvelous listeners. I enjoy being here every week with you. I have a really interesting guest today, and we're going to look at stuff that rarely gets looked at, and in particular, evolutionary psychology, how it relates to happiness and sadness, and how evolution relates, from my viewpoint, to guilt, shame, and anxiety. I think it's going to be really interesting, a conversation that I've not had on the air before in any great depth. Before getting to my guest, a couple of new stuff coming out. Would you believe that Prozac has now been approved as the first non-hormonal treatment for hot flashes? Think about it. Think about the chutzpah. Think about whether you can trust the FDA. We now know that people who take Prozac or any of the SSRIs are developing, in some cases, a lifelong sexual dysfunction. We know that they are developing over the years apathy and indifference. We know that that the drugs, if you try to withdraw from them, produce a lot, huge amounts of anxiety and depression and irritability and distress. We know they increase the suicide rate. We know all these terrible things. So this non-hormonal treatment, Prozac, under a new name here somewhere, this non-hormonal treatment is really, it's the hot flash from hell. And that's a headline. It introduces it. It's supposed to be help for the hot flash from hell, but it is the hot flash from hell. Folks, and I mean this really seriously to the women listening, if you think hot flashes are horrific, wait till you try to withdraw from Prozac after you've been on it for months or years. Look carefully into this. Read about this. Go on my website. Google Prozac adverse effects. This is one more disaster waiting to befall you, and it's going to be masqueraded as a new drug. The trademark, I don't know how to pronounce it yet, didn't have a chance to check it out. Ginger just handed me, you know, one of these ginger flashes. Brisdell or something like that. Brisdell, Brisdelle. I suppose it's pronounced in some lovely fashion. It's not Prozac. It's paroxetine. It's even worse. It's Paxil. I'm just learning as I look at this news flash. Well, everything I said about Prozac, amplify it for Paxil. Paxil, as many clinicians are now agreeing, is just about the most dangerous drug on the market and the most difficult to come off of. It can be harder to come off Paxil than heroin. So I apologize for sort of working my way through this newsflash that just got handed to me. But, hey, you're getting the information right when I am. Now, another newsflash from the hands of Ginger Bregan. The headline is, Mother's Little Antipsychotic is Worth $6.9 billion a Year. Abilify, folks, is bringing in more money. Doesn't mean it's the widest selling. It's highly expensive. It's bringing in more money than any other drug. Any other drug. Heart drugs, diabetes drugs. What does that tell you? Do you think there are that many psychotic people in this country? Of course, it's used to supposedly, if your Paxil doesn't work, you know, try Abilify. And the problems with Abilify are so legion, from tardive dyskinesia, that dreadful movement disorder that once you have it, rarely goes away, to the metabolic syndrome, early death. You can read, as always, the first half of my book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, is about the drugs and their harm, and documents it. And the second half is about how to come off these drugs. Now, something interesting that's going on, and we're just seconds away from meeting my guest, is that I'm now blogging on Mad in America, my friend Bob Whitaker's incredible website, probably the most active website in the entire field of critical psychology and psychiatry and mental health. And if you go to Bob's website, and again, most of my listeners probably know about Mad in America. It's also the title of one of his earlier books, Bob's earlier books. You'll see right there in the middle column, top of the page, front page, is my featured blog. And it's really an introduction to my new video, which is entitled The Psychiatric Drugs Are Much Worse Than You Ever Imagined. Psychiatric drugs are much worse than you ever imagined. It's just been up a couple of days now, a few days. It's got well over 4,000 viewers already. I'm happy, glad, and proud to be featured at the moment on Mad in America. And I think that Bob and I just have a marvelous collaboration over the months and the last year or two. I often invite him to speak at the conferences that I run. So this is really a great thing. So that's a lot of talk. I don't usually have so much talk at the start here, but I thought to tell you today. Now, Jonathan, are you there?
I am here.
Oh, and you're loud and clear, too. All right. My guest is a very informed, interesting person. His name is Jonathan Rottenberg. Jonathan Rottenberg. And his new book is The Depths. The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. And it's in hardcover. I have this book. I've looked through it, read some of it. It's interesting. It raises all kinds of interesting directions for looking at questions surrounding why do we get depressed. It's really a book that opens conversation. And that seems to be one of Jonathan's goals. Is to open conversation. He got his PhD from Stanford University, and he's now at the University of South Florida. My son-in-law, Chris, got his degree in social work there. University of South Florida is really an amazing, growing university. He's an associate professor of psychology, and he's director of the Mood and Emotion Lab. He's had what he calls generous funding from the National Institute of Mental Health. I've been generously attacked by the National Institute of Mental Health, I'm sure, at one time or another. Although offhand, I actually can't remember an occasion. He's just doing a lot of interesting work. He gets covered in Science News and Scientific American, New York Times. And in 2013, Jonathan started the Come Out of the Dark campaign. And as he says, to start a better, richer national conversation about depression. He lives in the wonderful city of Tampa, Florida, with his wife and his daughter and two dogs. And what can be the matter with a man who has two dogs? Nothing. Jonathan, introduce yourself in any way you like and talk about your new book.
Thank you so much for that introduction. I'm really happy to be here. Like you said, interested in having a broader conversation about depression, not the usual conversation that you hear. And I think the Peter Brecken Hour is going to be one of the best places to have this conversation. I guess what I would say to introduce the book is, as you know, the state of the national conversation about depression isn't very good. It's dominated by a discussion of whether or not people should take Prozac or other medications to Prozac or not Prozac. And there really isn't much of a broader discussion about mood and the sources of mood. And after all, depression, is defined by changes in mood. And yet the study of mood and the study of normal mood has really not had very much to say about why there is so much depression, and there's a real disconnection between the study of mood and, unfortunately, the study of depression. And I think the average person doesn't have much appreciation for where moods come from and why there is so much low mood now. And so I'm looking forward to talking to you about all those things, and including where evolutionary psychology and evolutionary psychiatry might make an important contribution.
Talk about your view of what is evolutionary psychology. You consider yourself an evolutionary psychologist? Is that the title you give yourself?
No, I would say that I'm an emotion researcher, first and foremost. But you can't get very far studying emotions, whether it's anger or fear, without appreciating that these states have function, that they have origin, even states that are really undesirable. When we think of pain, when we think of anxiety, not only do we have those states, but other animals have those states as well. And the reason is that when you look back, these states are solving common problems. So a species, if it's to survive, needs to have mechanisms to protect itself when it's become damaged. And so pain, though it's unpleasant, and we wish we didn't have it, if we didn't have it, clearly we would be in a much worse position. And so the study of emotion, I think, has to be grounded with a study of what the functions of these states are and what the origins of these states are. And I don't see how you can do that without studying the evolutionary history of these states.
Well, what do you feel the evolutionary history is of depression?
Well, it comes from our basic capacity for mood. So mood is essentially there to regulate our behavior. And again, not just our behavior, but our mammalian friends. And you could even go down the phylogenetic chain. I mean, I think it gets a little bit silly to start talking about mood in plants. But even much simpler organisms with simpler nervous systems have basic movement or tropisms, approach versus avoid, whether it's approaching food, avoiding poison, avoiding predators. And mood is there to help us guide whether we should be expending energy in approaching or we should be shutting our behavior down and holding in place. And so mood is there to make our behavior more efficient. It's ordinarily very useful, even though, we've clearly, the pleasure principle holds. So most people would prefer to be in a positive mood state than a negative mood state. But negative mood states also have their utility, which isn't to say that we should desire to be them all the time, or that there isn't a problem with depression now. I think that there is much more low mood than there used to be. But that doesn't really speak to whether or not low mood per se is an adaptation.
You seem to be suggesting that low mood, depression, is very much of an avoidance, a protection, are you saying, where you pull back, an opposite of engagement? You're hinting something about that, but not stating it outright.
Yeah, I'll state it outright. So low moods are there for situations where action might be dangerous or where there's simply nothing to be done. And you can think of a lot of examples historically. When I say historically, I'm not saying, in recent evolutionary history, but in deeper evolutionary history, whether it was a famine or even when an organism is hurt, or when there are all kinds of predators about, or when it's a snowstorm. There are all kinds of different situations where it is much wiser. Courage is the better part of valor. Discretion is the better part of valor, which is to say that it's much wiser to stay in place. Or in situations in which a chain of behavior is not paying off. So if you think of an animal that's foraging in one place, and is expending energy and is not getting any return on its investment. So if you think of a bear fishing for salmon and it's in the same spot, there needs to be a mechanism to get it to actually stop what it's doing if the behavior isn't paying off. And so low mood is, it's a very primitive mechanism. It can be, of course, elaborated on. I mean, I think that's one thing that we'll talk about is how low mood in humans is different. It becomes different because of our other capabilities, our capabilities for language, for culture, for self-understanding. But the basic tropism for mood, which you're right to point out, is it is an avoidance state. It is an inhibitory state. Is really in situations where we're faced with some kind of dilemma. It usually, for a strong low mood, it's a major dilemma. So, for example, when an important person or conspecific, so if it's another species, another member of the group dies, that historically, again, over deep evolutionary time, has been a moment to pause. Because when a conspecific that's close to you dies, it has a lot of implications for the future. Moods are future-oriented. So the question is what to do next. And usually when there, something that important has happened, it's better to look to others, try to get social support, analyze the situation, rather than just immediately strike out in a new direction.
Yeah, now, folks, I want to tell you that the first half hour, I'm really going to focus on Jonathan's, Dr. Rottenberg's views based on his book, The Depths. The book, again, is The Depths, The Evolutionary Origin of the Depression Epidemic. And then in the second half, I'm going to bring in my own book, which deals with very similar issues. You know, my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, which is going to come out in December. But right now, I'm going to just stay with Jonathan on his book. So kind of following what you're saying, so-called bipolar disorder or the tendency for people to get high and manic. Nowadays, it's mostly due to street drugs and antidepressants and stimulants. But there is a tendency for human beings to get extraordinarily high and extraordinarily low. That would be a kind of an engagement, disengagement phenomena, something along those lines?
Sure. I mean, it is possible for people to get stuck in the high pole of mood. And it's a bit more common for people to be stuck in the low pole. And what I'm hoping is for an integrated understanding of mood. So to understand what it is, all the things that are driving people into low mood states, not necessarily just clinical depression, because many of the same factors that are leading people to have an ordinary low mood, which is just say low-grade depression, they're really the same factors. You don't need a new framework. You can use the same framework to understand more severe depressed states. And I think actually that's something that's new and something that's really needed to help us develop a vocabulary for talking about mood in a better kind of literacy towards mood. And it turns out that there's a number of different sources of mood, and many of them are things that we can do something about. You know, so as I'm sure you pointed out, people often think that the main thing that you can do when you're in a low mood is to take an antidepressant, and that's certainly something that you can do, but I think that there's a much broader set of levers that people can and should be pulling to change their mood and understand their mood. And so I think the view in The Depths is actually quite optimistic because many of the things that move mood are within a person's control, maybe not perfect control, right? And some of the things that affect mood are temperamental, which is hard to change your temperament, but you can change many aspects of your environment, your social environment. You can identify thoughts and patterns of regulating mood that are not particularly helpful, and so on down the line.
Does your book address that? I was
it
looking
does.
Mostly at the scientific part of the book. Does it address the
it does,
recovery aspects? Good.
It does. You know, there's many things. Even though the book is a hard look at this common problem, and it's certainly a sort of condemnation of the status quo, despite, you know, huge investments in research and treatment. We've really not made tremendous progress, in, both on the scientific side and on the treatment side. I mean, I think that the standard treatments for depression get us a certain distance towards the goal, but we've kind of plateaued. So I think it's absolutely necessary to not leave the reader with a sense of with complete hopelessness, because the truth is that I think if people are more self-reliant, so I'm absolutely not advocating that people don't go to therapy or don't seek help, but there's a variety of things that people can do to understand their mood, either in concert with a therapist or on their own, and these are critical, I think, to not just being able to recover from a single episode of depression, but if you think of mood as a lifelong project, so you don't want your mood to be interfering with your major goals, with your hopes and dreams, you have to think of it in a much, much longer term scenario. And so I think that while it's not intended to be a how-to book, there certainly are a number of ideas, and many of them are very common sense. And again, some of the reasons why there is so much depression now has to do with some basic aspects of our routines that are really not in keeping with how our moods evolved. So our moods evolved to help us seek rewards during the daytime and rest at night. And so our whole mood system is very driven by cues of light and dark. And there have been big changes in the last 10,000 years to the amount of light that we're getting, to the amount of sleep that we're getting more recently. And these are, again, things that people can change. And I think that is profoundly hopeful, that there are things that people can change.
We're talking with Jonathan Rottenberg, and his book is The Depths. It's put out by Basic Books. You've got a good publisher. Let me make a brief comment on what is evolution, biological evolution. How does it work? And let me see if my explanation meets Jonathan's idea about it. I mean, basically, evolution says that there is a natural selection that goes on. And natural selection is the key. That's the mechanism. There's a natural selection that goes on that favors organisms that have survival qualities and ultimately reproductive qualities. In its pure concept now, people often speak of natural selection as favoring, you know, the spreading of genetic material. It's not just a matter of survival. It's actually survival only in the service of reproduction. So that if you have sparrows that are a dark color that suits them well in the forest, and then they move into the city, and they actually blend better with lighter colors and avoid predators with lighter colors, the ones with lighter colors are likely to be favored by the process of natural selection, and you'll get more lighter colored sparrows. Now, this is an actual fact, but I just don't remember whether it's the lighter or the darker colored sparrows that have been favored in urban England where this was studied. So that's the basic concept, is that over time, and it's gradual, it's seen as a very gradual process. There may be occasional ups and downs if there's a catastrophe that the organism is dealing with, but that in general there will be variations in nature, in organisms, when those variations favor that organism's not just survival, but more important, reproduction, then you're going to see more of that variation. Does that sound like a good discussion of what biological evolution is about, Jonathan?
I think it's perfect. And the insight is that in evolutionary psychology, that not only was there selection for, and is there still selection for, the physical characteristics of organisms, but that they're in part because the brain is an organ of the body, that there is also selection for psychological characteristics as well. And so you can have all kinds of psychological mechanisms like mood that are, that also just, you know, like eye color or arms and legs or binocular vision and so forth. But the other interesting thing that you said is that the aims of evolution are not progress, and they're certainly not happiness. I think that's another part of the quandary that we're in with our conversation about mood. We have so many people who believe that it's normal to feel happy, to feel ebullient, and I think contemporary culture really feeds this idea that one can easily be very happy. But if you look at evolution and how we're configured, we're really not configured to be to experience pleasure at a very high level for long periods of time. Pleasure is something that's meted out along the way as the organism is, in fact, moving closer towards those important goals of survival and reproduction. So when you ask her, you know, your date to the prom, and she says yes, you get that big rush of pleasure, which makes sense, but it also makes sense that it would fade. And that's sort of the tragedy, in a sense, you know, this kind of hedonic adaptation that, you know, we can buy bigger cars or do all kinds of things to try to give us a boost, but it's not necessarily going to give us enduring euphoria.
I think that's brilliant. I think that is so well said. The show's worth it to me just to have you emphasize that for my benefit. And folks, what he's saying is undeniably true. We didn't evolve to be happy. We evolved really to grow in numbers and to more effectively survive and reproduce. That does not mean, however, and this I want to deal with in the second part of the show, that human beings can't transform themselves and rise above the givens and the limitations of evolution. And, you know, this is it's kind of a bit more of an intellectual conversation than we sometimes have on this show, but I just think this is very, very worthwhile. Happiness is not something we're even built to seek. And in fact, I think that when we seek happiness, we're really running amok with ourselves. We end up on drugs. We end up, you know, without sexual morals or restraints. We end up with all kinds of problems if we put happiness. Now, what I do think is the secret to life is principled living, but goodness knows I can't say that we evolved to that point. That's something I think that is learned through wisdom and insight and culture. Very, very interesting the way you put that. We've got about one more minute, so actually I'll just reintroduce you, and then we can go to break. We're talking with Jonathan Rottenberg. His book is The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. Maybe we'll even raise a question about, is there really an epidemic, or is that drug company propaganda? And when we get back. But I'm looking forward to the second hour. We're going to have more conversation. I'm going to start the second hour with a brief discussion of the fundamental principle of my new book that comes out in December, which you can get in advance with a very good deal. You can get my new book in advance, but on my website. But again, I want to focus mostly on The Depths, the book by Jonathan Rottenberg. We will go to break anytime the music starts, and take up with a more complicated conversation when we come back. Hi, folks. It's Peter Bregan, and I'm back with the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. Usually I get a little break during the ads to talk to my guests about how the show is going. We missed out on that today, but Jonathan, I think it's going well, don't you?
I think it's going well. We're getting that fleeting kind of evolutionary pleasure. We can't count on it to last.
Okay. So here is the principle of my new book. I the last minute, I emailed the pages to Jonathan Rottenberg, but I'm sure he hasn't gotten a chance to look at it. The basic idea that I'm discussing in the new book, in part one of the book, is that human beings are the most violent and the most loving creatures on Earth. And as a result of that, we would have destroyed ourselves and our family life, because the more loving we got, the more we'd be exposed to each other's violence. And indeed, that is, even today, a problem. And that guilt, shame, and anxiety were naturally selected in people as inhibitors and restraints on willfulness and aggression in the family. So that when the child starts to first become perhaps assertive in ways the family doesn't want as an infant, toddling around too much, getting near the fire, whatever else, guilt, shame, and anxiety are inflicted or really stimulated, because they're built in, their instincts, they're built in, are stimulated, and the guilt, shame, and anxiety inhibits the child's aggression and willfulness, but only in the family. So it leaves us as violent and as obstinate and as willful as we can be when it comes to dealing with strangers in the world, which is a problem the world has struggled with forever. That's a thumbnail of what's a very elaborate theory. The second part of the book deals with three steps to overcoming guilt, shame, and anxiety. And the third part of the book is about love. It's about love as the answer to guilt, shame, and anxiety. Now, in my concept, depression did not evolve as a positive mood regulator. It's the unfortunate flaw of the built-in guilt, mostly guilt, but also shame and anxiety, that overcomes us and is inflicted, especially when we're abused as children. Then these instincts are exaggerated, and we end up in self-hate and self-abuse and depression. So I view it as an unintended consequence. So here's an interesting place to begin a discussion. Is depression an unintended consequence of these built-in emotions, guilt, shame, and anxiety, or is it somehow a regulatory mechanism that can get out of hand in itself? Jonathan, your response. You have thoughts about that?
Yeah, I do. So the way that I think about it is that low mood is a particularly good adaptation. It's a perfectly good adaptation, but the environment has changed radically in the last 10,000 years, and there are many factors that are setting low mood in overdrive for many people, so that it is on for long periods of time, inappropriate to the situation, and also more severe. So people actually are can be debilitated by the low mood for months or even years. And so I think of low mood as a useful adaptation that in the modern environment is not working very well. I think so you could tell a similar story for anxiety. I know in your book you have a somewhat more negative view of anxiety than I do, but I think it's because we have slightly different definitions of anxiety. But no, I don't think that. I mean, my goal is to reduce the sway of depression and low mood, because I think it has far too much sway over people, though the basic adaptation is fine.
That's interesting, and I think it's just something for people to think about and work on and look at as thoughtfully as you can. When I think back, I'm imagining that 100,000 years ago, when we got around the campfire after coming back from a violent hunt in which we slayed some creature larger than a modern elephant and chopped it up and brought the chunks home and tried to distribute it in some fashion or another among the families, that we were probably struggling in a very similar way to calm the violence down and not express it within the family unit and within the clan, and that inhibitory built-in, you're calling it an adaptation, that inhibitory built-in process of guilt, shame, and anxiety when we get ready to kill our neighbor or our kids, or just stand up to them in ways that would disrupt things. That was probably there all along. But God knows there are huge stresses built in from modern living. Do you want to say more about that, Jonathan, about, because I do think that that's very important. What's so different now in the last 10,000 years, starting with, of course, that we live in cities and have great agricultural resources feeding us in our cities. It's very new, folks. Very
it
new.
It is. It's everything in your environment is new. There are no computers. There's no light bulbs, no supermarkets. We obviously think of many of these changes as positive, but not all of them were very positive for our mood. And so the fact that people in general are much more sedentary than they were 10,000 years ago is not particularly good for our mood. The fact that people are getting far less light with indoor living, far less sunlight, that is not very good for our mood. And some of the modern routines, so actually people are getting light, but they're getting it at night. So a lot of people are watching television or looking at iPhone screens getting entertained, light shining in their eyes, it's disrupting their circadian rhythms, it's also delaying sleep. So a lot of people are, in the environment that we're in now, not in tune with our more natural biorhythm. And it shouldn't be a big surprise that people are feeling fatigued, they don't feel very tired when they should be at night, and during the day they lack energy. So that's some basic changes in our routine, but there are some also more recent changes that I think are really harmful for our mood. And it actually, and I can just say one of the changes alludes back to the idea that pleasure is something that we'll experience sparingly on the way to major evolutionary goals. I think that the self-help industry, which is a modern idea combined with social media, has given people very unrealistic ideas about what is normal to feel, what is expected to feel. People are doing a lot of social referencing, looking on Facebook and so forth, seeing their friends vacation and all the smiling people who seem like they're happy all the time. And so it raises the question that I think a lot of people are experiencing, which is, why am I not happier? Why am I not happy? And this is a question I think you would agree that it's not a good question to be asking all the time. It's not fundamentally about what activities should I be doing or what are the purposes of my life. But a lot of people are focused now on the question of how can I be happier? And I think that the self-help industry is really, a lot of it overpromises and makes for this a natural question. So some of the things are behaviors in our routines, and some of them are more recent cultural changes, all of which I think are kind of creating a storm for mood, a situation where the mood is really being set into overdrive.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. And if we look at the lives of children, the extreme way that they are being removed from anything remotely like what we evolved to do is most incredible. I mean, I don't think there's a tribe in the world or a clan in the world before very recent times that ever expected its children to learn outside of nature and inside of some roped-off enclosure where they were supposed to stay all day long while the adults went out and did all the interesting things. We are bizarrely inhibiting our children. Your thoughts on that?
Oh, that is so true. I mean, it kind of breaks my heart that with budget cuts in school districts, the thing that they're cutting back on is recess, because it's either too expensive to monitor the children, or that there are some liability issues. I think that it's play that's very important to children's development, but also is a part of their natural mood system is very dependent on the ability to be rambunctious and to blow off steam. And when you take that away, in addition to the demands of the classroom and sitting still in large groups and so forth, that and as you allude to, the way that children are divorced from nature and running around so often. I mean, I had a suburban, I don't know, I feel like I was the last group of kids that had this. And I'm sure that there are kids in rural America that have this, but in the suburbs at least. I was trusted to run around my neighborhood, be on my bike. Growing up, so when I raised my child in Florida, in a similar suburb, that was not the norm. And other parents had issues with my daughter riding her bike literally 5 blocks to school. There's such a fear about safety. And I really thought, I'm going to resist this because I think that this is very important for my daughter to have this experience of autonomy, this engagement. You know, the truth is that nothing bad was going to happen to her riding her bike 5 blocks to school. But I think what you're alluding to is that kids don't have the opportunity to be kids. And it shouldn't be surprising that when that isn't allowed, that when kids become adolescents, they're more predisposed to have some mood problems.
You know, there are even studies that show that 10 minutes of intense exercise before school does more than the drugs for calming kids down, which is a kind of an ironic way to put it. So maybe if we just gave them 2 hours of exercise, they'd be geniuses. I mean, it's so stupid, the current way. I differ with you on one thought. I don't think that the problem in the schools is simply a budget cutbacks. And I'm not even sure that's at all what the problem is. This has been going on for decades, and I think it has much more to do with federally imposed standards and state imposed standards, which force the school system toward testing out kids to prove their effectiveness, and that they're cutting out music and art and so on, because that's and exercise and gym and all, because that's not something that's being tested for. I really think that's much more the problem than budget cuts. It's the allocation of resources into rote learning in the hope that we'll catch up with Hong Kong in science and math and things like that.
No, I agree with you. I think that's probably more responsible.
Well, that's cool. That's good. Do you have do you get into educational issues at all in your work? Do you come up? Have you been working with schools in any way?
No, though I am very interested in adolescence, because adolescence, really, that is when a lot of depression germinates, middle school, and I feel like that would be maybe that would be a next step in terms of thinking about mood literacy and doing presentations in schools, because I think that children that age don't have much vocabulary for talking about their mood, in part, because of the dominant culture where, we tend to medicate problems, and we tend to be uncomfortable. I think negative moods make people uncomfortable, and we don't like to talk about them. I don't think that creates a good environment for adolescents who often do have problems with their mood and then don't feel comfortable talking to their friends about them, don't feel certainly comfortable talking to their parents about them, and so they struggle along until their functioning starts to deteriorate, and then people, their parents or the school will be on the child, but that's sort of too late.
Do you have any sense from cultural anthropology and other areas related to evolution, whether adolescence was such a period of craziness and emotional ups and downs before recent times, I'm trying to think about what I've read about Native Americans, and
right.
I'm not absolutely clear about this. Do you have any thoughts about it?
I think that it's a more difficult period than it used to be. We're asking so much. I mean, part of it is that what does it take for a young adult to become independent in contemporary society now versus, say, in 1850, when still most people, the majority of people, were still living on the land. Now, there were some important skills that you had to learn, and I'm not saying that it was easy then and it's hard now, but the degree of uncertainty about what a young person should do, how do you start your career? I mean, what's happened now is that a college education is no longer sufficient to get a job, or to get a good job anyway. And the definition of a good job, you know, that's also sort of eroded, a job that has benefits. And so I think in addition to some of these social things that we're talking about, there's also an economic overhang that I think impacts how adolescents in high school, in even college age children and young adults are processing the world. And I don't blame them. I think it is a difficult time psychologically to grow up, and it is more difficult to become a, you know, perceived as a viable adult in the whole notion of starting your own household and being independent from your parents. I think that's a very challenging task.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I'm thinking back to the area I've read a lot, studied some, you know, have Revolutionary America. And back then, I mean, by the time you got to be a young teen, a very young teen, you were helping on the farm or helping in the shop. You had functions to perform. You might or might not get your high school level education. You might even just go into another city and pick up some work, like Benjamin Franklin. He left Boston, went to Philadelphia, and found a job in his teens.
Right.
And that kind of activity, creative, hardworking activity for teens now is totally unavailable. I mean, very few teens are doing that. I think maybe more out in the country where I live are still doing it, but it's certainly not the preferred way. Instead, it's deferring, taking responsibility for yourself.
Right, and I think that it's hard for, I think mood is often connected to people's goals. And I empathize with adolescents. A lot of what they're really fed from the culture are some very, in a sense, that they're unattainable goals. So to become famous, to become fabulously wealthy, or to become the most beautiful. And these are often goals that adolescents are, and young adults are, walking around first and foremost. That is the goal that they must attain, rather than thinking of a more proximal, more attainable type of a goal. And when these goals don't work out, and they typically don't work out, the person is in store for a lot of negative mood. You know, not very many people can be the most beautiful. and I would also wonder historically whether that is another change, just particularly for girls and adolescents, the percentage of people who are defining themselves by whether or not they're the thinnest, the most looking like a model, and so forth. That to me seems that it is something that's changed in the last 40 or 50 years.
Well, I think it comes from having a lot of useless activity, in part, where you're busy hemming skirts and weaving blankets and helping out a hoe in the field, and also looking for a man at some point or to marry who is going to be a good provider for you and your children. These things are all set out there. I think good looks are sort of maybe one of your advantages you might have in achieving your goals. But it's not going to be a thing in itself. It's not going to be the be-all and the end-all, which it has really become tragically for so many young women.
Yeah, I mean, my daughter is wonderfully well-adjusted freshman in college, but she was not totally immune to this. I mean, she would spend 20, 30 minutes taking selfies. And the thing that really kills me is that I know that some of her friends could spend an hour or could spend 90 minutes. I sort of agree with you that this isn't, it's not just, you know, from the perspective of an adult and not very productive activity, but that there's all kinds of painful self-comparison. Because that's what a lot of the social media is about, but who is the most liked, who has the most friends, and people are constantly comparing themselves to other people rather than thinking, what do I want? Who am I? I think that that's part of the problem.
Boy, I would like to see somebody do a study of the effect of the mirror on human life, because we evolved, the only reflections we ever saw maybe were in a pond.
Right.
I mean, literally, we evolved before metals were even developed, let alone mirrors. So while certainly looks surely had some sort of a stimulatory effect on each other in terms of mating, it probably was really different criteria
right.
that people were looking for back then. And nobody could be preoccupied with their own looks, like Narcissus,
right.
when he saw himself in the pool, because there just wasn't so many opportunities to do that. I mean, think about, wow, never thought about that. What a difference to live in a world where you can't even see what you look like.
Right, versus a world where you can't escape, because if you're not taking the pictures, then someone else is, and they're posting the pictures, and everyone is commenting on the pictures.
It's there all the time. I walk through my bathroom as a long, not long, it's got a mirrored wall, maybe mm-hmm. 8 feet long, as I walk in, and often I glance over and I wonder, who's that older gentleman following me into the bathroom? I mean, we've got such self-awareness to struggle with mirrors, and yet we're totally, through evolution, this emphasis on our personal beauty. Again, it couldn't have been like this. It couldn't have been a thing in itself. It had to have been, if anything, just an instrumental advantage for attracting people. That may have even at times become a disadvantage if you didn't want too much attention. It's interesting to think about just how we're unprepared by evolution to live in the world we're in. But I do believe for myself that the ultimate solution has to do with principled living, with learning to love, ultimately learning to love. That's the third mm-hmm. half of my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, is about learning to love in order to bring out the best of what we've been given, because it's not all we've been given. We've been given willfulness, violence. We've been given such a cauldron of responses. What do you think about love and evolution?
Well, I think love is a very important state, clearly selected for it. It cements relationships in important ways, because we make long-term commitments to people even when it's not practical. So we remain, you know, humans often remain with someone even though the other person is hurt or even though the other person is treating them badly. And so I think that this notion of love is absolutely crucial. I guess I'm interested in hearing this idea about love being teachable. Because I think our default notion is that it's kind of instinctual. Right, and you can't really teach a person to alter that. Do you think that people can be taught?
Oh, totally. Because I think it's built into us by evolution, the capacity to love. I think we are all sources of love, or we'd be dead. We wouldn't be able to relate. We'd be wrapped up in a hole somewhere. So I think we all have the capacity to love, and it's a matter of learning to dare. Because we've all been hurt in love growing up. We've been hurt by rejection. We've been hurt by our own foolishness. And I think it's, I mean, this is my work. My life's work as a therapist is helping people find their ability to love and to reach out to other human beings. And my definition of love is joyful awareness, so being joyful about other human beings, about life, and not about ourselves so much, but about all the wonder around us. So, folks, we're getting near closure here. My guest is Jonathan Rottenberg, spelled like it sounds, R-O-T-T-E-N-B-E-R-G. Jonathan has written an interesting invitational book to think more deeply about the origins of depression and really about the origins of human nature. The book is The Depths. And thank you so much for being on the show, Jonathan. It's been a genuine pleasure to have a really intelligent conversation with you.
Ah, it was a privilege. I'm so glad I was able to come on your show.